Accession number 16254, Reel 3.
Commander Lamb, Reel 3.
We steam south and pass down the Korean Peninsula en route for Hong Kong and Singapore. I, at that time, was on the morning watch. Being a naval officer now, I had to get my watchkeeping certificate, and I was studying hard to do this. When the captain came up on the bridge at some early hour in the morning, I think it was around 5 o'clock, and a telex came in from the Admiralty saying that the South Koreans had invaded, sorry, the other way around, the North Koreans had invaded South Korea. He looked over to the shore in the remote distance and said, "Funny to think there's a war going on over there." We then steamed on for another 4 hours before a telex from the Admiralty came in telling us to turn around and return to Japan. The captain that morning informed the ship's company we were not on our way back to UK and that we were going back to Japan, and I think the groan could have been heard for 100 miles. We went back to Sasebo in Japan. It's a big port where the Americans were in force at that time, and waited there for a period of about a week. The orders then came that we were to support the American forces defending South Korea against the North Koreans. And so Triumph steamed down to the Yellow Sea. Dates and times are a bit vague now after all these years, but we arrived there sometime, I think, August, and started the attacks against various communist positions around the border and south of the border, where the South Koreans, where the North Koreans were invading. During that whole period we were at sea, I never went ashore at Korea. The next stage of the operation.
What was the character of these ground attacks?
Very similar to the previous ground attacks, directed against targets and tank targets, in this case armoured personnel carriers and actually we also took on a bus convoy. It was during this time that I got hit. I didn't realise I'd had any small arms fire till I'd just left off the attack, which was at that time against this bus convoy, and started to return to the ship, which was some 30 miles offshore. The first thing I knew was that I saw my coolant temperature gauge alarmingly rising, and a terrible smell of glycol and fumes in the cockpit. The C-547 I was in at that time had the Griffin engine. I opened the cockpit, prepared to bail out. In the distance, I could just see the carrier. I'd called the carrier on emergency, and I kept going for a bit. I think I was too nervous at that time to bail out. As the smoke started to fill the cockpit, the carrier was into wind, and when I was about 3/4 mile away, the decision was whether to carry on or bail out. I decided on the former, put my wheels and flaps down, and came straight in on the deck with the smoke rather blinding me. As I touched down on the deck, or actually before I touched down, the engine had seized, the prop was still. The feeling of relief was tremendous, but the most unfortunate incident was that the flight deck party, four people of the flight deck party, went to push the aircraft out of the way for the other aircraft to land on, and they all burnt the skin off their hands completely by pushing on the cowling of the engine. I felt very sorry for this, because they were the only casualties of my landing. They were taken to sick bay, where their hands were treated after a while, but they were off for about a week. It just showed what the Griffin engine, or Rolls-Royce Griffin engine, would put up with. The engine was a complete write-off. That was my most hair-raising incident. For that, later on, I was awarded a DSC, but I always considered that DSC was really because I was too scared to bail out.
How much success did the Seafires have against armoured vehicles?
The cannons were very successful, because we had armour-piercing shells.
How many tanks do you think you might have knocked out?
This is very, very difficult to say. One attacked, saw the shells possibly hitting, and then if one had any sense, one got the hell out of it. One didn't hang around to be shot down. It was usually one's number four. At that time, of course, I was a senior pilot and a flight leader. It was usually one's number four, coming in last, who had the chance to report any success from the aircraft ahead, but also he was in the most vulnerable position for attack, as the gunners had already lined up on their flight attacking. And generally, if we could, we attacked from different directions. In other words, if we were at 4,000 feet, one would peel off and attack north, the other would come in from the east, the other from the west, the other from the south, to try and give surprise to the armament on the ground. This wasn't always ideal, because sometimes one liked to attack down sun, to keep the sun in the eyes of the gunners, and the one coming in up sun was silhouetted as a target by the gunners.
Were there many losses to the squadron?
I think we lost two aircraft at that time.
Did you see them lost?
One pilot was rescued, one we never heard of again.
Did you see what happened?
No. In my flight, I didn't have a loss.
What was morale like?
Very good, very good. I think, as far as I remember, it was excellent.
What was the intensity of the enemy resistance like?
It was spasmodic, insofar as certain areas were very well defended, especially around Pyongyang, the capital, and that area. And also, when we went in the second phase of the operation, for the Allied, although it was mainly American, landing at Incheon, we gave the cover there, and the flak was fairly heavy over that area. We didn't take on any targets at that time. We were combat air patrol against any MiGs or enemy aircraft likely to attack the invading forces.
Did any enemy aircraft turn up?
Yes. There is a famous story of Hoagy Carmichael, one of the pilots. Possibly I should say here, in Triumph, we didn't have any enemy aircraft. But on the later ship, Theseus, that went out there, they did. And it was on Theseus that Hoagy Carmichael, one of the pilots, shot down a MiG from a Sea Fury. This had its good and bad points. The MiG flew right in front of him, and he fired his guns and actually hit it, and it went down in flames. This had the unfortunate effect of confirming to the Sea Lords at Admiralty that the Sea Fury was a better combat aircraft than the MiG, which was rubbish. It was a lucky shot that downed the MiG, but the after effects didn't help us insofar as a feeling of complacency possibly developed in the board of Admiralty that we had combat aircraft equivalent to the Russians of that time.
Any other memories from your operations in Korea?
I think that about concludes our time in Korea. After a period, we were relieved by Theseus.
Was this still in 1950?
This was still 1950. This was October, roughly 1950. Theseus came out to relieve us, and we returned to the United Kingdom.
Now, if we can jump ahead again to 1956 and the Suez Crisis, can you give details, please, of your part in that?
Yes, in the intervening years, 1949 to 56, I volunteered and was accepted for the Empire Test Pilot School, did the test pilot's course, and became a test pilot at Boscombe Down for 3 years, testing all the latest aircraft coming into the Navy. After this period, I was made commanding officer of 810 Squadron, which was equipped with Seahawk jet aircraft. I formed the squadron at Lossiemouth in 1955, after which, after having got my watchkeeping certificate in the Navy, and we worked up in Scotland around the Moray Firth. Before embarking in HMS Albion for a trip to the Med and the Far East. Coming back from the Med and the Far East into 1956, I'd had a year as CO of the squadron and was about to hand over the squadron to another CO when the Suez Crisis loomed. We were immediately taken from Lossiemouth and embarked in HMS Pulbert and sailed for the Mediterranean. We went to Malta, had a short workup in Malta, and then in November found ourselves off Egypt, some 30 to 50 miles for the invasion of the Suez Canal. The first strike in the Suez campaign was to be against aircraft on the ground at various airports. These included Cairo West, Ismailia, and one or two others. There were a lot of Lancasters, and Russian aircraft, IL-28s, if I remember rightly, on the ground. We took off pre-dawn from the ship. It was dark, an hour before dawn, so that we arrived over the Suez at first light on November the 1st. I led my squadron in on Cairo West, where we attacked and virtually destroyed all the aircraft on the ground. 8 flamers, this is an aircraft that flames, were attributed to my flight, of which I personally got 2. The flak was fairly light, so after the first run, we turned around and made a second run on a different target. The effect of these strikes was literally to obliterate the Egyptian Air Force. I must say here that while we were going in on Cairo West, other flights were going in on other airfields, covering a whole number of airfields in that area. There were, I think, 5 sorties that day, but by midday, any likelihood of air opposition was written off.
Did the Egyptians get any planes up at all?
No, not to my knowledge.
What were you flying?
Seahawks.
How did these compare with the Seafires?
Well, of course, they were great. One had a wonderful forward view. The worst part about the Seafire was, of course, one had a prop with a very long nose, and it was very difficult to see ahead. The Seahawk, you sat right forward. Tremendous forward view, jet aircraft, speed in the 500 knot region as opposed to the 300 knot region. Very good fire capability, very manoeuvrable.
Were you all elated after this?
Yes, very, very much so.
And what was Bulwark like to operate from as compared with the previous carriers you
had? Oh, it was a larger carrier than the escort carriers I'd been in the war. This was still before the days of the angled deck, so that one had straight land on towards the barrier. But the Seahawk was a very good deck landing aircraft, and any deck landing incident was a rarity rather than in the past. It had been a hazard that one had at the end of a flight, but it became almost a pleasure to deck land, especially in the calm seas, which one had at that time off the Egyptian coast.
Any other sorties you did during the Suez?
Oh, practice? Yes, yes, we did something like 20 sorties over the 5 days, until it was decided that the operation should cease. One of the biggest problems of the sorties was that the American carriers in the area were putting up aircraft, and we were vectored to intercept these aircraft, which did not show any IFF, identification, friend or foe, and an awful lot of time was wasted by being vectored onto friendly aircraft. And in point of fact, we found the Americans, who were of course against the Suez operation, a nuisance with our aircraft in that area.
Do you think they were doing it deliberately?
Yes. Yes, I think it was part of the policy to try and get the Suez campaign to cease. After the third day of Suez, the carriers steamed up to the area of Alexandria. I went ashore, spoke with the army commander at that time, who said or fourth day this was, at the time the ceasefire was coming into operation, if they'd only given us 36 more hours, we would have been at Suez.
How did you personally feel when it was all called off?
Disappointed. A waste of time. Although, during the Suez operation, we didn't lose any pilots in my squadron, and I don't think any of the other ships lost a pilot, it was, again, an anticlimax.
What did you feel about the political opposition that was whipped up in Britain?
We could only listen in on the radio, and it was fairly remote from us. We didn't know whether the Russians were going to come in on the side of the Egyptians. We were a bit concerned about that. We knew that the Americans were neutral, but neutral with a bias towards the Egyptians. They were not likely to come in against us. There was a possibility of Russian aircraft being sent to Suez. We were rather concerned about that because of the superiority of the Russian aircraft at that time.
What was the nature of the other operations after the strike on Cairo West?
Mainly combat air patrols, as I said, being vectored onto targets, and a lot of them useless targets, American aircraft not showing identification, and to cover the army landings at Gamel, the parachute landings. The French, of course, were there in force. And there were occasions when aircraft were called down to attack ground targets, although I personally wasn't called down on any ground target in the Suez operation. One pilot was shot down over the Suez area, and he managed to bail out on the Sinai Peninsula, where the Israelis welcomed him. He bailed out. Smokey Cowling was his name. He was a Canadian pilot in the Fleet Air Arm. And when he bailed out, he landed in the desert and was immediately surrounded by friendly Israelis, soldiers, a lot of them women. He was feted with drink, cigarettes, and according to him, all the love he wanted, before 15 minutes later a helicopter landed to pick him up, which annoyed him greatly because he was just beginning to enjoy himself. That, as far as I know, was one of the few casualties, or not casualty, one of the few aircraft loss during the Suez campaign.
Just going back to the Korean War, I think there's an incident that we've left out that you saw.
Yes, there was one rather unfortunate incident which was quite needless. One of our sorties was to investigate a blip on the radar when we were on combat air patrol off the south coast of Korea. We recognised the aircraft from a distance, which was an American B-29, and to be friendly, I was leading a flight of four aircraft. Two of us flew up the port side, two of us on the starboard side, and waggled our wings. Just then, all the guns of the B-29 opened up on the aircraft on my side, and my number two was hit. He immediately inverted and bailed out. This was, of course, on the Seafire 47s, and parachuted down into the sea. We peeled away from the aircraft and followed him down, saw him land, get in his dinghy. The aircraft crashed some distance away from him in the sea, and then we called the ship Triumph, and she vectored one of the attendant destroyers, a C-class destroyer, to the spot. At that time, we didn't have helicopters aboard for air sea rescue. They hadn't arrived in the Navy, in the Royal Navy at that time, although the Americans had them. We stayed as long as we could with Mr. White. He was a commissioned warrant officer who was in his dinghy. And then we had to leave as we were running out of fuel. But another flight was scrambled from the ship to take our position and circle him whilst the destroyer made its way towards him. He was picked up quite successfully and suffered very little damage apart from a dislocated arm. It was one of these unfortunate incidents which rather soured Anglo-American relationships at that time, as the whole incident was so needless, and it made us wary of the Americans, who were far happy, as we termed it, with their guns.
How is it that they could have made such a mistake?
It's impossible to understand, because the C-5 is a very distinctive aircraft, and I just think their aircraft recognition was very poor, or that some slap-happy gunner just wanted to have a go.